This is Friday Forum. I'm Rachel Cobb for KGLP. I'm here with Sean Flynn, who has written a book.
Yes.
Words on the Rocks.
That's right.
This is, shall we call it an experiment in format? There's some stream of consciousness, poetry, reflections on the tribulations of growing up in communist Romania and in Transylvania. What has influenced your writing?
Just my unique background gave me a different perspective on life. You know, living in the West for my adult life, most of it anyways, it's kind of interesting. Sometimes feel like the observer as opposed to the participant. The format of the book and the way things came out was just organic to more or less who I am. Words on the Rocks wasn't, premeditated in the sense that, I wanted to break certain grammar rules and so forth. It's the way it came out. I've been tormented by concepts and realizations through life, and they're always dying to have birth in this world. And when I write, it's a form of catharsis for me. I need to sometimes, and once I do, then it gives those concepts a place to rest, and it gives me a place to rest, too.
There was a film out now in theaters entitled Arrival, and one of the themes in this film that I was thinking about as I was looking over your book was that the language that we communicate in influences how we think. And in fact, on the inside leaf of your book, there is a circular graphic that is very much like the kinds of written language that the aliens in this film use. I just wondered, having spoken several languages in your life, how the particular languages that you have communicated in have influenced your thinking and how you write.
That's a great question, actually, because language is... been a study of mine for a very long time, and Wittgenstein, a philosopher at the turn of the century, dealt with language, and his first book came out with statements basically saying that words are these direct representations of meaning. There's a sort of objective. And, it took him a while, but in the latter part of his life, he wrote another book saying, I've been totally wrong. You know, language is just something that keeps certain things in and certain things out. It's contextual. And I've been toying with the whole concept of language and how to use it in a way that brings out this non-discursive thinking that we all humans have, within us. And it just needs to come out. You know, most language is just, black and white, hot and cold. We describe things in terms of a dichotomy. But Zen koans, for instance, they deal with this all the time. They try to take you away from that discursive thinking between right and wrong and good and bad and black and white to something that is primordial, something that's before that, something more direct. To tap into that, it makes you feel alive, at least for me anyways.
Did you grow up after the time of Ceausescu?
During and after.
And so you were very young when the Ceausescu reign came to an end and he and his wife were executed. But you always grew up with that specter of what we might call the tyrant or the dictator in the foreground. When did you realize that there were a variety of different forms of governance in the world?
Well, it's interesting because as I grew up, everybody usurped the government. There was just... way there's the black market, the gypsy world. They had no borders. We came and went as we pleased. We understood the way things worked in a more fundamental way. Bribery was rampant and probably still is in Romania and other parts of the world. People need things. People need food. They need water. And, you know, you learn how to get along. So the government was just something there that was necessary, but it wasn't something that we felt any sort of we weren't hampered by the government necessarily. We just knew that there are certain things that we need to respect. There are certain boundaries that we need to go around. But there was a working relationship, so to speak, in that sense. And then coming here and seeing people really feel akin to the government and actually participate in government and, you know, people vote. People really, you know, have this belief and, to some degree, I think, an illusion that the government is the end-all, that it's going to solve our problems, and it's the mode of operandi for, incorporating a whole group of people, which is not entirely true. I mean, governments are just these porous organizations that, business transactions occur with or without rules. Kind of like grammar and language, you know. You use it to get your point across, but it's arbitrary and it's porous, and you can break the rules. Sometimes you have to break the rules to achieve your means.
In some respects, you grew up in circumstances where your parents weren't even necessarily following the strict rules of society. Your father was Irish, but you never really got to know him, I assume, since he left when you were very, very young. Your mother, Romanian gypsy, I would guess, from what I read. So growing up, you mention in your book that you were rather proud of the fact that you considered yourself, shall I say, a bastard?
Yes, absolutely. I'm a little different, and maybe it's part of my culture, but, that life is about challenge, and you can't have resilience, you can't have character if you don't have some challenges in life, suffering. And, I started out, I feel blessed in a way because I started out with more challenges than normal. And as life went by and I sort of stumbled over some of these challenges and was able to overcome consciously some of these challenges, the challenges became less and I became more sophisticated and actually appreciate a little challenge. That's what makes us alive. That's what makes us feel alive. And it wards off fear, because once you overcome a challenge, then you see fear for the imposter that it is. And you begin to appreciate the concept of death. You know, death and fear are these bitter enemies. And if you're a friend of death, and I'm not talking just physical death, but, you know, the death of our ego is something very real to most people, especially in the West. And if we fear that, then we're not going to be able to understand death, and death won't be the important concept, the important fuel for our consciousness to make us feel alive. And so, yeah, I'm very proud of being a bastard and having come from a place where we foiled death often and made light of it.
Many writers come from a perspective of feeling like outsiders and writing from that perspective. Has that driven your writing as you've grown up?
I'm not sure how to answer this one. I think for me, the writing was just this necessary piece, a component of my life to sort of remind me who I am, It's interesting that, you know, when I was writing Words on the Rocks, and, you know, it became this thing, Words on the Rocks, I was a different person. There was this different perspective that I had. And now that I'm reading Words on the Rocks, it's almost as if there's two different people here, because there's two different perspectives. There's the writer and the reader, and it has fueled some growth for me personally. And I think the book is gonna definitely shake people off their perspective a little bit, and confuse them, and maybe make them appreciate some of the things they have, hopefully.
And while we're speaking about the book, Sean, could you read an excerpt that you think our listeners might find exemplary of the style of your writing?
I was thinking about what I wanted to read to the audience today from Words on the Rocks, and in light of the recent elections, I thought maybe this one might play out a little bit. So here it goes. This one's called The Enemy. It's always better to have an enemy to fight, plot against, to scrutinize, observe, hate, trying to understand only for the purpose of finding a fissure or weakness here and there, so we can somehow win. And God help us when we do, and where would we be then? We would have no choice but to look at ourselves. Oh, shit.
I think that's... good commentary on the current situation.
I have another one if you like. This one's called The Trick. The trick to making it through this life is to embrace all the pain it has to offer. Guzzle it down, the venom of life, like it's going out of style. Roll in the mud. Take every opportunity to ride every roller coaster you can in this amusement park. Scratch, bite, and scream as you get pulled back into perfection.
And there was one I came across. This is not California, but when I think of writing as an observer from the outside looking in, can I read a little bit of this?
Sure, of course.
It's a poem called Malibu Boys.
Oh, yeah.
They can surf better than me on a bad day. They have lots of money and lots of time, but no direction other than the left or right passing of the bong. These guys don't shave and don't dress chic. They don't have to. The money and their talent and their looks gets them the girls. They are an accessory item, like their Rolex watches. Their machismo is projected through their appearance of soulful genius. But that is exactly what they are missing, and they don't know it. They know deep down they're missing something crucial, vital, but they don't know what it is. What a strange hell.
Yes. You know, there are many different kinds of hell, and definitely one is when life is just so easy, you know, when you have everything. I think there was a long time ago, I'm probably dating myself, there's the Twilight Zone where this man ends up in this place where he gets everything he wants, and he thinks he's in heaven, but after a while he realizes it's hell, because there's no more challenge. There's something integral within us as humans to want to overcome, to challenge, to have that gift of overcoming something, of mastering ourselves. That's one of the reasons I think we're here on this roller coaster, is to accomplish something, to do something with ourselves. When you don't have that opportunity, when you get robbed of that, it's a horrifying thing. And you know, the worst of it is you don't even know it. You don't know what you're missing, because you've got it all, right? In this materialistic world, if you ask an average person what, if you had one wish, what would it be? Most people will tell you they'd want $100 million or $1 billion or whatever the amount is. Very few people would tell you, you know, I'd really love to have the satisfaction of, you know, having that lawn mowed just the right way, or something like that, or some accomplishment.
whether in life or in writing. Who are some of your mentors, either directly or indirectly?
Well, I've had some personal mentors. Some of them have been, people that have challenged me in life. Carlos Castaneda, the petty tyrant, you know, the person who's going to aggravate you and spur you and create the challenges in your life. That's their job, is to be the person that designs some challenge for you, whether they know it or not. And some of those people, and I don't want to go into names, but some of those people have been my mentors in a sense, because once I've mastered myself, then they became what Castaneda called them, petty tyrants. Bukowski definitely had a big influence. I'm a big fan of Tom Waits. His music, his way of just thinking outside the box and grabbing some sound or grabbing some piece of language, and that evokes and stirs people to contemplation. They've been kind of like my heroes in music, and Bukowski definitely has, you know, suffered greatly and has written about it in a you know, very interesting perspective.
What do you think of the idea of a songwriter receiving the Pulitzer Prize for Literature, as happened this year with Bob Dylan?
Yeah, very happy. Bob's been definitely at the top 10 there of one of my heroes, and he is Americana. He is, he's what we need right now is people like that. And absolutely, I'm all for it. You know, language shouldn't be this barrier, as Wittgenstein said, to keep things in and certain things out. We have to challenge ourselves as artists, writers, poets, songwriters, whatnot. We have to challenge ourselves to tap into that non-discursive thinking, where we get into something deeper, something more spiritual, something more primordial. We have to spur people to self-discovery, because that's what we're lacking here in this culture, is self-discovery. You know, if you don't understand yourself, how can you understand others? And if you don't understand others, then there's probably a clue that you probably don't understand yourself. And so that's a good place to start.
Do you have any interest in the composition of music or working with music, given that you're a poet?
I do. I did write a piece called Lyrics to a Punk Song that I, originally kind of wanted to develop, and I'm still looking into it, and there's definitely more writing to come. Words on the Rocks is my, kind of getting on the beachhead of publishing, so to speak. But, I'm a big fan of punk music. I've always love the vitality of it, and when it first started out, people were saying this is going to be a fly by night, but it's sort of like rap music. There's elements there that is always going to be a reflection of principles in life that are immutable, and punk is a kind of a living music, so to speak. I think writing some lyrics for music and would be something that I would be interested in.
You are listening to Friday Forum. I'm Rachel Cobb for KGLP, here with Sean Flynn, author of Words on the Rocks, a compendium of essays, poetry, stories, and more. Looking at your website, wordsontherocks.webs.com, it wasn't clear whether you considered this fiction or nonfiction. It has a somewhat nonlinear approach, but the idea is that it does make you think. Now, if people are interested in looking at this book, I think it's available on Amazon.com, Words on the Rocks.
Yes.
And the author is Sean Flynn, S-E-A-N-F-L-Y-N-N. And you can also go to the website, wordsonthrocks.webs, that's plural, W-E-B-S.com. If you have questions or you'd like to contact Sean, the non-deplume email is wordsonthrocks@allinfreeproductions.com. Or if you get lost, you can always call us here at the station, 505-863-7626. How did you begin thinking about this book? How long has this book been in the making?
Good question. It's never at first was intended to be a book. It was, like I said, it was, you know, my way of freeing the monsters out of me, of being tormented by these realizations and concepts. And they needed a voice, so I just put them down on paper. And, you know, much later, there's a bit of storytelling that we gypsies like to imbibe in, and over libations, of course. And so there's a, you know, part of my culture sort of oozed out into the language and into the, you know, what I spoke about. So it just kind of eventually accumulated. And then it wasn't until I met Brad Johnson, my publisher, who's my midwife, sort of speak, for changing all this writing into a published work that it is now. Words on the Rocks probably would have never existed if it wasn't for Brad. And he's not only my publisher, he's a dear friend of mine and my confidant. And he was the one who had the fortitude and the know-it-all to make this happen. So I want to give him a big shout out and cheers for him, because this would have never happened if it wasn't for him, really.
And of course, even though you have poetry published in this book, Words on the Rocks, I don't think there's anything precluding you taking some of that poetry and submitting it to journals. Have you ever submitted your writing to journals?
Once, a long time ago, I did submit one poem to a journal, and I don't quite remember the name of it. And it was just something that sort of came up as an opportunity, and I took it. So there is one other small piece published, and it's a short poem called Change. And, I'm not sure exactly where it's published now, but I do know that it is published.
Well, perhaps you'll consider resubmitting some of your other poetry, even that in this book, in the quarterly journals and such. You know, that I'm sure that there would be a receptive audience.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a great suggestion. There is definitely more coming. I do have more stuff written down. We just wanted to get to a place where we got a book going, Brad and I, and as we speak, actually, we're working on more material coming out. And Create Space has my book as well, Words on the Rocks, and it's going to go out internationally. I think it's already out internationally through Amazon. So in certain bookstores, I think there's one in Thousand Oaks, and several in places in L.A. where it's going to come out in some bookstores. So there's opportunity for the reader if they're glutton for punishment. They're looking for an uncomfortable place to be linguistically. I dare you.
I mentioned that you have a nom de plume, Sean Flynn, and, you know, this is not uncommon. You probably value your privacy, but what are some of the considerations in writing under another name?
I'm a very private person. I feel like privacy is a gift that not everybody gets to enjoy, and knowing some people in show business, and it's not some place that I want to endeavor in. I want people to just know the writing and connect with the writing. It's not really about me. I feel like a lot of times that writing came from what I call the muses. You know, I was just like a sort of a hose where the meaning came through and I gave the words, but the muses is what really inspired me to put out what I put out. And so I don't want it to be about Sean Flynn. I want it to be Words on the Rocks. I wanted to pick up these words, you know, like rocks, and you stack them up, the sum is greater than its parts. That's art. When you take things that are relatively common, maybe unique, and you assemble it, you do something with it that is something bigger than itself. And so it's not so much about who does that, you know. The person who stacked those rocks on the front page, I do not know who that person was, but, you know, the art is there. And that piece of themselves, that higher piece of themselves is there. And the name doesn't really matter. I mean, it could be, you know, Donald Duck was already taken, so I chose Sean Flynn.
Well, that's as good as any, and it reflects somewhat your father's side of the family. And given that you didn't know your father very well, that is perhaps significant. Did you ever reconnect with your father later on?
No, I never did. Unfortunately, he passed away, and we never got that opportunity, and so I felt, this is my way of sort of connecting with him, and it's also appreciating a part of myself that's within me, but not acknowledged so much because, you know, my father died. I never got to know him, but it's to acknowledge that Irish part, and there's a very deep and long history of poetry and very rich language in the Irish culture that, I wanted to pay tribute equally to, you know, my gypsy culture.
You could look at some of the similarities between the disenfranchisement of many of the Irish peoples and the disenfranchisement of the gypsies, for example.
Right. Yes, absolutely. You know, it's an interesting dichotomy that you have these two cultures that, they're both looking for some sort of legitimacy, especially the Irish culture. You know, they wanted a country and deserve, you know, full country. So my heart goes out to them. And, you know, the gypsies are happy the way they are. They don't want to change. And I don't blame them because, countries are in some ways not entirely, they're like these empty shells of what we think they really are. Governments, like I said, are porous. They're not the end all. And we need to take a look at that realistically. We need to be true to ourselves, and we need to, you know, really see what's going on in the world and how the world works, because it's not just this country, and what's happening right now in this country. It's the entire world. It's the way we do business. It's our economy. It's like a grammar that keeps us in a sandbox, and we need to find a different economy. We need to find a different way of interacting with ourselves so that we don't have to enslave a certain portion of humanity while another portion is got more. They end up being the Malibu boys. You know, they end up like words on the rock. They end up just getting everything and robbing themselves of the most important things.
And that's the whole problem with nation building, is that it swallows up the ethnic minorities, the cultural minorities, and there's very little left once the larger nation is done with it.
Right.
It happened to the American Indians. It's happened throughout the world.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I've read a lot of Native American philosophy, and that's another group of cultures there that my heart really goes out to, because they got it right. I recently wrote a piece about that, and they understood greed for the imposter that it was, and it is, and they didn't succumb to it. They actually lived their moment. They weren't concerned with future. Their past was something that they looked to learn from and grow from, but they weren't living on this material plane, and it's fake. You know that this is just a make-believe sort of experience for everybody, so that certain very few selected group of individuals can enjoy all the benefits, and everybody else sort of scrambles for the breadcrumbs. And the natives weren't like that. Certainly the gypsies are not like that. They're seen like that by the outer world. They're seen as these below par culture, but they are where they want to be, and they have each other, and that's far more important than a Mercedes or whatever it is that makes people happy materialistically.
Have you ever had an interest in blogging? The reason I ask is that the way in which you write, the style, episodal in some cases, reminds me somewhat of publications that have come out of the blogging experience.
Yeah, that's another good question, Rachel. I'm talking to Brad about it. I'm not the most technically advanced human being on this planet. I do understand what blogging is. My fear is I don't want to force things coming out of me. I want to just let the stream run its pace. And sometimes blogging can be demanding, and I have a sort of knack for wanting to help people and please people. And with blogging, it puts me in a situation where I'm not sure if my artistic experience is going to be maximized. So I'm toying with the idea, and it's probably going to happen. I want to be careful. I want to give everybody my best. I want the writing to be of the highest quality by my own standards. And if it is, then I'm happy. That's really what I want, is to give the best of myself, whatever comes through me, so that hopefully somebody out there changes the way they see things, and it helps them.
I'm going to ask if you would feel like putting on your huckster cap, your car salesman cap, and explain to KGLP listeners why they should look for your book, buy your book, download your book, and read your book, Words on the Rocks.
If they want something different, if you're a reader and you feel like there's a stale place in literature at this time, I urge everyone to consider buying the book and seeing something that's different. It might make you feel uncomfortable. It might challenge you a little bit. You might find it a bit funny sometimes, too. There's definitely things that are not entirely comfortable for people, like, you know, the theme in some of these things is death. And, you know, fear is definitely something that prevents most people from thinking about that. So I want to urge the readers to have a challenge. You know, character, even from reading, can be brought on by just the sheer act of reading something that's perhaps risque or different or just wacky. And I can guarantee wackiness, that's for sure, if that's something that you might be interested in. So Words on the Rocks does deliver on that respect.
Well, there are examples in your work of your sense of humor coming out. How important is humor for you in your life?
Critical. Yeah. Humor is the nectar of the gods, as I call it, because it's able to transform whatever is actually happening into whatever it is that you want to have happening. You know, ultimately, it's not the situation that controls us. We control the situation, and humor is the most effective, most useful tool we have in our arsenal to create energy, positive energy out of whatever happens, you know, whether it be pain and suffering or, you know, some things are just naturally funny, and I'm a big fan of humor. I love comedies. I love comedians, and I feel like I'm this humorous character just stumbling through life, even now as we speak. You know, I kind of never thought I'd be talking to you on this phone right now. So yeah, humor is definitely huge.
All right, Sean, I want to read just one more excerpt. This is from the opening pages of Words on the Rocks, your new book. And this is from your opening chapter, Shkola. Is it pronounced Shkola?
Right.
Yeah.
Shkola.
Shkola. Yes. Romanian for school.
Yes.
And I just want to read a little bit. You write about a time when you were in the first grade in this Romanian school.
Yes.
8 a.m. sharp. I am sitting very uncomfortably in a desk clothed in wool, feeling more like sharp chainmail clothing on bare skin. My introduction to government conformity from my personal culture who thrives on its opposite. I am scared, shitless. I am a very shy kid to begin with, and I have gas. The teacher is straight out of a Hitchcock novel with a birthmark the size of a planet right on her upper cheek. I am not hearing most of her 30-minute diatribe spoken in such overtly articulated and aggressive tones that spittle forms on the sides of her mouth before my very eyes. It was something about the brutality or the quantities delivered when certain infractions were committed. I was no stranger to that system, the birthmark combined with her beady eyes that perforates each and every one of our soft frontal lobes is the only thing on my radar. Sound took a back seat, and the visual effect was driving. The tone, not the content, is what had me captivated. Years later, I realized she had missed her calling. Hollywood would have paid her millions to act as a witch in the movies. I sat there motionless. I was captivated by the horror of the moment, afraid to fart, or even to breathe for that matter. I was lost in my own universe. My soul was traveling back through the portal of the womb to places where I was royalty, where I had a legion of servants to attend to my every whim. Needless to say, I just checked out and left my body to deal with the duty of being present. I was in my happy place. I, in fact, would have not remembered a jot of her verbal performance, which mainly amounted to the do's and don'ts of school procedure, her own anal retentive class system, etc. I would have shied away from the entire speech if it was not for her last statement, which brought me back with such shocking force. Her last statement was followed by a silence that sucked the air out of the room. And And if you don't like what I just said, then you can just pack up your books and go home. Go home? You mean if I don't like all the things of which I did not listen to a fucking thing you said, I can just pack my shit and go? Yep, judging by that drop-dead silence in the room, this truly is what she said. I confirm this statement by her pitchfork stare into the soft brains of us, the sheep in dyed wool, looking at her with eyes of terror and awe. I felt like the only sane human in that room. I packed my books faster than a New York minute and sailed out of there so fast I must have left everyone stunned, including the teacher, for an extra 30 seconds. This was long enough to allow for my escape. All I remember is a girl's foot in my way as I was making the getaway. So at the time, it probably wasn't that funny.
No, it wasn't that funny, but it just was happening when you read it. It was my first lesson in irony, and there's concepts as kids. There's always first as you grow up, and that was my first. In our culture, you say what you mean, and you mean what you say, and otherwise there are dire consequences. And so, when this teacher introduced me, probably the first statement of irony that I probably heard as a human being, at least in this life. And it didn't go over well, but I survived it, and I learned that there's a lot more to life, especially other than mathematics and reading and writing, that I need to learn. That's going to keep me out of trouble, at least out of pain.
Well, that experience as a child in school is a microcosm of the people, the gypsies, Transylvanians, Romanians, surviving the Ceausescu regime, for that matter.
Yeah, we as a child, I don't know the mechanisms entirely of how that was able to happen, that we actually still exist on this planet. But at the time, as a child, everything's playful, and we were not concerned with some of the bigger picture stuff. But as a child, I remember that there was plenty of intimacy in the community. There was plenty of I never felt lonely. I never felt like I needed anything. I had nothing, but I literally feel like I didn't need anything. Most of the time I played with rocks. It's another reason I titled Words on the Rocks, because to me that word rocks it's full of meaning. Rolling stone, and even our culture, rocks, they're hard and they can hurt, and so forth. So yeah, back then, it was a pretty simple life, and the government and Ceausescu, they were just entities out there in Netherland that we weren't overly concerned. They do what they do, as they say, give unto Caesar what is due unto him, and so sort of that was our kind of attitude about it. That's their tribe. That's what they do, and this is what we do, and we try not to get in each other's way.
Of the time when you first left Romania, what are some things that still stand out in your mind about the what I might call culture shock, or the differences that you saw in the world as you moved away from there?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first day of school here, and I wouldn't call it culture shock coming here, more of a culture pleasant surprise. I just was completely dumbfounded by how amazingly gracious the Americans are. And I still am. I'm still a patriot at heart for America. I still believe in the American spirit and their sense of values, their deep sense of very giving values that they have for not only themselves and their own culture, but of the whole world, and acceptance. I mean, I felt completely accepted. I felt like a rock star in some ways. And like I said, I've been a very shy person all along my entire life. And, you know, to come here, they're intensely curious about me and about my culture. And at first I was a little suspicious, but, you know, I found out that nobody really had a mean bone in their body. There's nobody that intended to do me harm in any way. And, you know, the whole process, the whole educational system was night and day, you know, conformity and all that stuff, especially back when I came through the school system here, was very lax, and I'm very appreciative of it. It allows people to be themselves, and you know, in the end, it's messy. You know, like democracy is very messy and sort of ugly, and it's not always the outcome we want it to have. But in as the whole enchilada, so to speak, as a whole, it's by far the best thing that we can come up with, given the reality of life.
Were you brought here with your family, or did you have to come here alone?
No, I was fortunate to come with my mom and other family members. You know, luckily Ceausescu did us a favor. His government was opposed enough to our government where we could fall under political asylum here and get a fresh start. And we had other, you know, community members from the old culture where they were here, and they took us in, and you know, there was a kind of a smooth transition. And you know, being an immigrant, my heart goes out to all the immigrants, you know, and I want to take them all in, because each and every one of them is priceless. They are, each one of them could potentially be that one person that can change things for us here. And I think that's what makes America great, is the people coming through. Whether they stay or not, it doesn't matter. It's the allowing people to just do their thing. As long as they don't bother anybody else, it's going to be the best thing for everybody.
One of the things that led to the results of this recent election was this fear that we find in a large segment of the population, especially the undereducated, about refugees, immigrants, whether from Mexico, from Syria, doesn't matter. Do you have any thoughts about that aspect of the uncertainty of this time?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we have to look past what just happened. We can't be stuck in this point in time, because it would just erode all the things that we stand for as Americans. We have to be bigger than this. We have to be bigger than just a presidency. We are more resilient. We are far more diverse than anyone can imagine. And just because something happened that was unexpected, I'm no political, I don't really follow politics that much intensely, because I know it's just this little piece of a greater puzzle. And we have to look at ourselves as Americans. We have to be a tribe. We have to be a community, diverse community, of course, but we have to stick together, even though some of us may have, far different aspects. We can't make enemies of ourselves, because that's when everything is lost. We do it mostly because we want to escape our own responsibility to ourselves of self-discovery. It's not so much about what really happens out there, because if we do our own work, then what happens out there won't matter as much, and also it'll happen differently quote-unquote, out there politically, because we're all going to be sitting in the right place. But fear is taking over this country, you know, and materialism and fear is going to erode us from the inside out. I'm not worried about the enemies from Syria or places like that. It's minute compared to the potential damage that we do to ourselves as a society by being paralyzed by fear and, you know, misogyny and the ugly things of life. We have to be all-inclusive. We have to find a win-win situation.
Any last words for our listeners, Sean?
If anything that we talked about today, Rachel, sticks to the listener's mind, I urge you, pick up a copy, Words on the Rocks, and hopefully it does something to you that that's beneficial.
I've been speaking with Sean Flynn, author of Words on the Rocks. If you're interested, you can find the book on Amazon.com and elsewhere. You can also go to the website wordsontherocks.webs.com, or you can email wordsontherocks@OLLYOLLYALLINFREE. Productions. That's Words on the Rocks at OllieAllInFreeProductions.com. Or you can contact KGLP. Sean, thank you for spending some time talking with me today.
Rachel, thank you. Thank you very much for your time, and I want to thank all your listeners.
That concludes this edition of Friday Forum. The full interview with Sean Flynn is available online at KGLP.org. Just select the podcast button. For KGLP, this is Rachel Cobb. Thank you so much for listening.